All right, Alexander, we have the results, pretty much. We have the results of the elections in Canada. There's still some results that are trickling in, but really we have a full picture as to what's going on, and it's the same picture as before the elections. I mean, it is almost a carbon copy of exactly the structure of the parliament before and the structure of the parliament now. Trudeau, minority government, he won, but with a minority. He wasn't expecting a majority, I don't think, either. So I imagine Trudeau is extremely happy with the results. And as much as I hate to admit it, he took a risk and he won. And he won. And he is now saying that he has received a mandate. The Conservatives are pretty much on level as they were before, but this would be considered a loss for the Conservatives because they just did not do any better. Period. No. The other parties are also pretty much carbon copy. The People's Party, Maxime Bernier, they did well on votes. They grew by 3x, 3-4x, but once again, they failed to win a seat in Parliament. So a mixed bag for them. They did well on their popularity. But when you get down to the real important stuff, like getting someone in Parliament and effecting real change, they fell short. But gosh, it is literally, when you look at the numbers, a carbon freaking copy of what it was before the elections. It's incredible what the results.
Absolutely. And of course, the important thing to get to understand and to take away from this is that Trudeau remains Prime Minister of Canada. And he's going to remain Prime Minister of Canada for the foreseeable future, because realistically, there's not going to be a challenge against him from within the Liberal Party following this result. And I think that the real purpose of this election was not to gain a majority for Trudeau. It was to secure his position as Prime Minister for the next few years, and that's exactly what he's achieved. Because even though there's been a minor, very minor slippage of support, it's overall remained steady, and both the Conservative Party and the other opposition parties have made no progress against him at all. So I'm afraid what this has done is that it has consolidated his position as Prime Minister of Canada. Now, I say that, I want to make it absolutely clear that, you know, this is not at all the result I would have wanted to see. I'm no supporter of Trudeau. On the contrary, of all political leaders around the world, he is the one who perhaps raises my hackles most intensely. But I cannot deny the facts. The facts, it seems to me, are indisputable. He gambled in order to secure his position in power. He called an early election, which was intended to prolong his position in power. I'm sure he anticipates that there will be problems ahead, and the gamble has paid off for him. As you rightly say, I don't think he was really aiming for a majority. That was simply the pretext he came up with to justify calling the election, because he had no other reason to do so. So I think that's the story of the election, the overriding election. Trudeau remains Prime Minister of Canada, and his position is secure, and his government is secure, and he will remain Prime Minister for the next couple of years, at the very least. No challenge from the Parliament, no challenge from the opposition, and no challenge from within his own party either.
Why do you think this happened? Is Trudeau truly a popular leader in Canada? I mean, we get different signals on our channel and in our comments about Trudeau, and you hear different perceptions about Trudeau on the international stage. A lot of it due to the fact that he does, you know, really make a lot of gaffes when he's speaking. Those make the headlines, but in foreign policy, he also messes up quite a lot in his rhetoric and when he's traveling around. But does he have such a strong base of support? Because if you look at the numbers, that's the conclusion that I come up with, that he has a rock solid base of support, because the numbers literally are matching across the before and after.
Absolutely. Well, I think, again, we have to accept a fundamental reality, and it's a very difficult one sometimes for people like us to accept. And that is, clearly there is a very strong constituency electorate in Canada that is extremely antipathetic to Trudeau and to what he does. But clearly also these policies, these identitarian policies that he follows, this woke policy, this woke approach to politics that he takes, wins him a great deal of support. Also, it's deeply polarizing and divisive of societies, as we've seen in the United States, as we're increasingly starting to see in Britain also, though in British politics still works to a slightly different rhythm. But, you know, we're gradually working towards that position in Britain too. But it's also now worked entirely in Canada. People increasingly are voting either in support or against these issues. And that gives people like Trudeau a solid electoral base. It's overwhelmingly concentrated in big cities. I suspect it's also strongly based in amongst younger people. But the fact is, there is a critically large mass of the electorates in certain Western democracies or what call themselves democracies, the United States, Britain, France, Canada, clearly, would support these kind of policies. And, I mean, you know, that is a reality we have to face. And it means, by the way, that these very divisive policies that we've seen being implemented will continue to be implemented. And we will also see all the problems that come from those continue and continue to get worse. But that's the reality. It's an election winning formula that some people have now hit upon. It's worked for Trudeau. He is the grand master, if I can put it like that. He won't like me calling him a master, by the way. I suspect he doesn't like that kind of language, but he's the grand master of playing this kind of game. We're going to see more of it in the United States, especially. And we're also going to see it playing itself out in places like France and Britain also.
Yeah, absolutely. The identity politics, the fear of what's going on with the coup, all of that stuff seems to really bring the results in.
Yeah.
And Trudeau took a risk and he won big. There's no way you can deny that. And I say it as someone who doesn't want to say that.
No, he did. Absolutely.
Yeah, he won
feelings.
Big.
Yeah. My feelings also. He understands his electorate and they support him. And we have to accept that fact. And there's a lot of people who have these views and who care enough about these things, apparently, to vote for Trudeau, with whom they continue to identify. This is despite all the fact, you know, that he appears with, you know, black facial coverings and all these sort of things. It doesn't seem to have any effect. Ultimately, they're so committed, so many people are so committed to these sort of things that they continue to vote for him. And that's the reality.
Yeah, he's got the ground game, he's got the media wrapped up, he's got the big business, and he's got that huge base of support, and it seems like it's very much in the urban areas. But one thing that we can't take away from these elections is something that we talked about in the elections that happened in Russia, the parliamentary elections, and that is that you don't have any real opposition in Canada either. And, you know, Maxime Bernier, his party is true opposition, but it's only a two-year-old party. It's going to take many, many years, if not decades, to get to where it needs to get to, if you look at the case of Nigel Farage and UKIP and how long it took them to progress to become not even a leading party, just to become an influencing force. It took them a long, long time. So you don't have real opposition in the Conservative Party. And I think that's something that we need to discuss, Alexander, in the same way that we talked about United Russia and the fact that there is no real opposition there. You have to look at Trudeau and you have to look at the political landscape in Canada, and amongst the big, powerful parties that are vying for power, I think it's at this moment in time, it's safe to say that Trudeau is the only game in town.
Absolutely. I think that's entirely right. I mean, he dominates politics in Canada. Again, it's incredible to me that that should be so. You would have thought that such a polarizing figure would provoke a strong opposition. But that clearly hasn't happened. And there's no sign of it happening anytime in the future, because all the big parties in Canada, to a greater or lesser extent, are signed up to this project, and they're not really opposing it. And you're quite right, there is a small party that's now emerged, and it's growing in strength, and it's increased its support from 2% to 5%, and maybe it will grow further. But that is very much a work in progress. It took, as I said, Nigel Farage something like 30 years to build up his political movement to the point where it became a real sustained political challenge. He was one of the most talented politicians in British politics, as I repeatedly say, but it took him a very long time to achieve that. And even then, I mean, with him departing the scene, we can already see in Britain how, you know, we swing back towards the default positions that existed before he basically broke through. So it takes it's an enormously difficult task to really challenge this. Now, sooner or later, challenged it will be, because, of course, basing politics around these kind of issues is not sustainable in the long term, not just because there are always going to be people who will not accept this thing, which there will be, by the way, but because ultimately it doesn't address the real problems of our age. It doesn't really look at the, you know, underlying economic or political problems or problems of, you know, grand policy. This isn't really what it's all about at all. So sooner or later, it will crash. But the reality is, as of today, as of now, it is indisputably the big political force. It's the big movement. They managed to create an entire language based around topics like identity issues, climate change issues, those sort of issues. And that's now the big issue that that divides people and decides the way they vote. And for the moment, that's the reality. It's a reality I find extremely difficult to accept and understand, but it is one which I have to accept because it is the reality that just expressed itself in this election.
All right, two questions to wrap it up. I'll give you the first one right now. How did the Conservatives in the UK overtake and overrun the Labour Party? Because at one point in time, it looked like the Labour Party was invincible. That's how it looked at one point in time. The Conservatives were kind of, you know, a very secondary party, it seemed, especially during the Blair years. That's where it seemed like Labour was like a force to be reckoned with. How did that change? And are there lessons for the Conservatives in Canada to take from that? Because there is no doubt the Conservative Party in Canada needs to seriously think about these election results. I mean, they really need to debrief, take a look at what just happened, and change direction in a big, big way. Are there parallels to how things flipped in the UK?
Right.
Because now you have a Labour Party that looks very,
very weak.
Maybe
very
the recent polling is a little misleading, but it doesn't look as it once did back in the day of Blair.
It doesn't. But I think you've got to be very careful about this. I mean, the first thing to say is that what happened in the mid-2000s is that the new Conservative leadership under David Cameron basically adopted the same identitarian policies as Blair did. And against the leader who succeeded Blair, Gordon Brown, they were able to do that fairly successfully. I mean, Cameron looked more like Blair than Gordon Brown, who was the Labour leader at that time and Prime Minister, did. So, I mean, they had that advantage in some way.
Is that what O'Toole was trying to do? Is that what O'Toole was trying to do, maybe?
I think he was. But, of course, you could play that game effectively against someone like Gordon Brown, who, you know, was old Labour, he was of an older generation, he was Scottish with an odd accent, which many people in England didn't appreciate, and he came across as a rather, shall we say, you know, male type of politician. And I think that worked against Gordon Brown. But of course, against someone like Trudeau, it doesn't work And that's I think, the first thing to say. But the second thing to say is, of course, the Conservatives in Britain were very lucky politically in that the election which took place where they won against Labour happened against the backdrop of the 2008 financial crisis and its aftermath. And that obviously did place the skids to a great extent under the Labour Party. But then the single factor since then, which has massively consolidated Conservative electoral and political dominance, has been Brexit. And there's nothing similar to that, it seems to me, in Canada, because what happened was that the Labour Party stuck very much in the sort of Blairite trap, remained totally committed to keeping Britain within the European Union. It eventually came round to backing the disastrous electorally disastrous second referendum idea, for example. Whereas the Conservatives showed much more tactical skill in adjusting to the change in the political landscape created by Nigel Farage. And, of course, there was always a strong faction within the Conservative Party which supported Brexit. So it was Brexit, ultimately, that sealed the Conservative dominance of the political landscape in Britain. Now, I don't really see anything similar happening in Canada. I mean, there's no great issue like Brexit that's going to, I think, overturn the politics that Trudeau, as I said, has invented. So I think, you know, we can't really look to Britain. The Conservatives can't really look to Britain in order to base themselves upon what, to find a way through. What I think, if you want me to say what I think the Conservative policy ought to be, I think they need to pursue a much stronger policy of redefinition. They need to be much clearer what they oppose about Trudeau and not appease him in this way. But, you know, you've got to always remember that there's probably a lot of people in the Conservative Party in Canada who also support these kind of policies because they believe in them too. And that's always the problem, you know, in Britain and, of course, in the United States and across the, you know, the countries which I will still call the Western democracies. I mean, there are lots of people in Conservative parties who, in terms of social policy, are no longer Conservative at all. And that's the reality. I suspect the one place where you still find a lot of resistance in the Conservative parties, in the Republican Party in the United States. But I don't see that in Canada at all, and I don't see that elsewhere. Certainly, I don't see that anywhere in Europe.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that O'Toole definitely tried to play Trudeau's game, and, you know, he's not going to beat Trudeau at that identity politics stuff or the mandate passport stuff either, which he was also in support of. It seems to me that Canada would be the Conservative Party would be better served if they got a more Canada First populist type of leader who just goes to break this neocon conservative stranglehold that they have on the party, just goes to break that and just kind of forges a different, a more populist conservative policy and platform. They would be better served if they had that. You may want to comment on that and then just wrap up the video, Alexander, and just answer one final question, which is, did the globalists win? This was a globalist victory.
Well, I can answer the second question first, which is, of course, they did. I mean, Trudeau is, again, I mean, he's the archpriest of globalization and globalism. So from their point of view, they, you know, they're taking out the champagne corks. This is exactly what they want. And to be very clear about those sort of people, I mean, ultimately, they're not interested in identity politics or anything of that kind. They have a manipulative approach to them, because what they do is they use those types of politics to take away, to peel people away from a real analysis of their agenda and of what is going on. So that's from their point of view. It proves that this bait and switch policy, where, you know, you get people talking about all kinds of things, you know, issues, social issues. You know, I have to be careful what language I use, rather than talk about issues of economics, issues of, you know, foreign policy, those sort of issues. Well, what they've just seen in Canada is another example of how that strategy works. So the globalists have done extremely well. Now, we talked about Nigel Farage and the way he incrementally built up a challenge from the bottom. But of course, there is the other way, and that is that you get capture, if you like, of the Conservative Party by an electrifying personality like Donald Trump was, which is what happened in 2016 in the United States. Trump came in, he challenged the Republicans, he took them on their own game, he won support from across the party, and he, very much against the wishes of the Republican Party's establishment, became the nominee for the presidency, and he went on and he won the election and he became president, and he retained his support throughout the time he was president. And what is indisputable is that, in fact, he actually increased his support during the time he was president. So an electrifying, charismatic personality like that can certainly break through electorally. But always consider how difficult it is for a person like that to break through. The entire political system in every Western country now works in order to prevent that kind of personality rising to control of any kind of party. So we saw what happened to Donald Trump when he was elected, how the entire political class, including, let's never forget, the Republican Party itself, or at least his congressional leadership, basically combined against him, how he was harassed, investigated, continues to be smeared, continues to be investigated, was twice impeached, found himself unable to fill the cabinet with his cabinet with people of his choice. We saw the problems he ran into in the United States, and that's in a country, the United States, with a relatively open political system. It is theoretically possible for someone like Trump to stand in the primaries and get themselves elected to be the candidate, the nominee for the presidency of one of the big parties. In Canada, in Britain, in France, in other Western countries, it's much more difficult, because the political system in those countries is much more closed than it is in the United States. And to be straightforward about it, I think the chance of a politically, right-wing conservative figure take a populist, an electrifying, charismatic figure, taking over a political party in one of those countries is incredibly difficult, almost all but impossible. Let's just take an example of one Western country, Germany, where the CDU, going into an election, it chose the bland, consensual figure of Armin Laschet, somebody who is as close to Merkel as possible and who fully endorses all the type of identitarian politics that we're talking about. And it rejected the alternative, Herr Merz, who was the person who seemed to be a more charismatic, more dynamic, more right-wing, more abrasive, more populist figure. Now, I don't think Merz, by the way, is actually a challenge to the system in the way that Trump was. I suspect that if he had become leader of the CDU, things would have turned out pretty much the way they have already. But having said that, you see how the system rejects anybody who comes from outside or from any one of the big parties to try to challenge this structure at all. So that's the reality at the moment. I don't really see challenges within the big parties. I think we're going to have this kind of politics continue for the time being until eventually, as I said, reality overwhelms it, which it will. And by the way, not before very long.
Yeah, reality will hit the world, will hit the West. It'll hit Canada really, really hard. And I think it'll be sooner rather than later. But I'll give you two examples, Alexander, of populist electrifying leaders that had to change their direction and had to change their policy because the system was so difficult to go up against. I mean, Trump really was an outlier because he really took the system head on and he never backed down. I'll give you the case of Salvini and I'll give you the case of Le Pen, two electrifying populist leaders who gained a lot of support. Salvini was so close to leading Italy. But because the system is so stubborn, so difficult, so tough to deal with, they had to change their direction. And these are two people that were, I don't know if they were indicted, but they definitely were pursued by the legal structures in their countries as well. I mean, the system is extremely dirty and vicious. I mean, you have to be a very extraordinary type of politician to want to go up against what we have in the West.
Absolutely. It's relentless. It's very, very difficult. You have to be an exceptional figure to take it on. So far, the only person who's done it and has up to now managed to win is Viktor Orban in Hungary. But, I mean, you know, the challenges to him are also mounting. And we now see a concerted attempt in the coming elections to vote him out. And this extraordinary coalition bringing the left, the Social Democratic Party, the former Communist Party of Hungary, together with what, you know, until a little while ago was considered to be the absolute unacceptable neo-Nazi right, the Jobbik Party, but it's now been rehabilitated because it's against Orban. So, you know, we see how the system is prepared to assimilate even these most extraordinary figures in order to go against someone like Orban. And the other country that's trying to stand out against all of this, which is Poland, well, they've been slapped with more fines. They're facing constant judicial harassment. They're being told to close down their coal mines. Poland still relies on coal for 80% of its electric power. They're facing all the same pressures that we see right across Europe, and of course in North America too. So this is the frame of policy that all political leaders across Europe, across the North America, are expected to abide by. If you're a leader who knows how to play this game, like Mark Rutte in the Netherlands or Justin Trudeau in Canada, then the system will work for you, unless you are a politically exceptional politician like Nigel Farage or Viktor Orban. You're going to find it impossible to break through. And even if you are a Viktor Orban or a Nigel Farage, well, you're going to face enormous problems and enormous pressures. And some of them, people like Salvini and Le Pen, have capitulated in the face of it. And others like Donald Trump, well, they fought a very tough fight. But at the moment, you know, he's no longer president. And that's the reality there, too. So, you know, it's an incredibly difficult system to break. And it's unyielding and relentless at the same time.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Guys, go to theduran.locals.com. You'll find a link down below. Go to the Duran shop, 10% off. Use the code REALNEWS. Pick up a t-shirt and Rumble, BitChute, Odyssey, and SuperU is where we have all our videos on those new media platforms. Take care.